Welcome to Vicksburg. Superbly situated on bluffs above the Mississippi River, some 200 miles north of New Orleans. A place to enjoy fine views and good southern cooking. Well, normally.
Hotel de Vicksburg. Bill of fare for July, 1863. Soup, mule tail. Entrees, mule head stuffed a la mode. Mule side, stewed, new style, hair on. Side dishes, mule salad. Mule kidney stuffed with peas.
Inventive, I think you'll agree, but perhaps a little repetitive. Anyway, the end of the meal was less mulish.
Dessert. White oak acorns. Beech nuts.
Delicious. Vicksburg dominated the Mississippi. In May 1863, the northern armies of General Ulysses S. Grant laid siege to the city. Hence that menu, drawn up with black humour by one Confederate soldier. The siege of Vicksburg was appalling, foreshadowing Europe during the Great War. Soldiers in trenches, sometimes only yards apart, trading shots, grenades and even friendly banter. Citizens burrowing deep into the yellow clay for shelter, as one of them, Dora Miller, recorded.
Cave digging has become a regular business. Prices range from $20 to $50 according to the size of cave. Two diggers worked at ours for a week and charged $30. When we went in this evening and sat down, the earthy, suffocating feeling as of a living tomb was dreadful to me. The hills are so honeycombed with caves that the streets look like avenues in a cemetery.
Grant directed the strangling of Vicksburg with cold calculation. But eventually, after 47 days, the Confederate soldiers were literally starved into submission. Some of them sent their commander, General John Pemberton, an anonymous note stating,
"Our rations have been cut down to one biscuit and a small bit of bacon per day. If you can't feed us, you better surrender us than suffer this noble army to disgrace themselves by desertion. The army is now ripe for mutiny, unless it can be fed."
Vicksburg capitulated on the 4th of July, 1863. Pemberton reckoned he could get more generous terms on that day. But for many Southerners, surrendering on Independence Day added insult to injury. The 4th of July wasn't celebrated again in Vicksburg until the end of World War II. But Northern troops were jubilant. Captain Ira Miltmore wrote home to Illinois,
"The backbone of the rebellion is this day broken. The Confederacy is divided. The Mississippi River is opened, and General Grant is to be our next president."
That last sentence was a touch premature. Grant didn't move into the White House until 1869. But Vicksburg turned him into a true celebrity. In the East, the 4th of July brought news of an even bigger battle. Back in the spring, Confederate General Robert E. Lee had run rings round the Union Army once again in Virginia. Emboldened, he persuaded the Confederate leadership to authorize another invasion of the North, threatening Washington and Philadelphia. He led 70,000 men into hitherto peaceful areas of Pennsylvania, but ran into the Northern Army at the little town of Gettysburg. After the initial confusion, the Union line gradually curled itself like a hook along some low ridges south of the town. It was a strong position, too strong in the judgment of Lee's senior corps commander, James Longstreet. But Lee was tanked up by the victories in Virginia. After 2 days of fierce fighting at Gettysburg, he was sure that the Union army was about to crack. And so, on the 3rd of July, Lee ordered Longstreet to attack the centre of the enemy line on Cemetery Ridge. That meant advancing nearly a mile, uphill and across open farmland, against an enemy dug in or sheltering behind stone walls and backed by strong artillery. Longstreet protested vehemently, telling Lee,
"I have been in pretty much all kinds of skirmishes, and I think I can safely say there never was a body of 15,000 men who could make that attack successfully."
but Lee was immovable. So Longstreet grimly set about arranging his troops. The lead division was commanded by General George Pickett, a dashing Virginian who looked like a cavalier with his long hair worn in ringlets. At 3 o'clock, after a thunderous artillery barrage, Pickett asked whether his men should now advance. Choked with emotion and unable to speak, Longstreet simply nodded. The Confederates moved out of the woods, fanning into line, and then marched forward briskly and in silence. To all who watched, it was a scene of terrible beauty. Frank Haskell from Wisconsin was one of those waiting on the opposite side of the field.
More than half a mile their front extends, man touching man, rank pressing rank, and line supporting line. Right on they move, as with one soul, in perfect order, without impediment of ditch or wall or stream, over ridge and slope, through orchard and meadow and cornfield, magnificent, grim, irresistible. The men had little need of commands, for the survivors of a dozen battles knew well enough what this array in front portended. The click of the locks as each man raised the hammer to feel with his fingers that the cap was on the nipple. The sharp jar as a musket touched a stone upon the wall when thrust in, aiming over it. And the clicking of the iron axles as the guns were rolled up by hand a little further to the front were quite all the sounds that could be heard.
The Union infantry held fire until the men in grey were within a couple of hundred yards. Then 1,700 muskets went off at once. The Confederates were literally blown apart, limbs, heads, and knapsacks flying into the air. Other Northern soldiers poured withering fire into the flanks. At only one point did the Southerners reach the Union line, and within minutes, most were dead or prisoner. Longstreet had been proved dreadfully right. Only half of the 15,000 made it back to their lines. Tearfully, Lee rode out to meet them.
It was all my fault. Get together and let us do the best we can towards saving that which is left us.
Next day, the 4th of July, in heavy rain, Lee started the retreat to Virginia. His wagon train, full of wounded, stretched back 17 miles. Gettysburg was the high water mark of the Confederacy. Never again did Lee invade the North. With hindsight, the third day of Gettysburg seems dreadfully similar to the first day of the Somme. It took months to clear up the battlefield. Contractors tendered for the grisly work of burying the bodies. The winning bid was $1.59 per corpse, pro rata for limbs, torsos and heads. And a special cemetery was officially opened 4 months later. The featured speaker was Edward Everett, one of the most famous orators of the day. President Lincoln was asked to deliver only a few appropriate remarks. In fact, Lincoln nearly didn't make it at all. On the morning of his departure from the White House, Tad, his 10-year-old boy, was too sick to eat breakfast. Lincoln and his wife Mary had already lost two sons, one of them to typhoid fever only 18 months before. Convinced that Tad was about to die, Mary became hysterical, begging her husband not to desert her at such a terrible moment. He had literally to pull himself away in order to get to the train. Tad did survive, but not for long. A somewhat delicate child, he died at the age of 18. At Gettysburg on November the 19th, 1863, Edward Everett talked for nearly 2 hours. When he finished, people went off to relieve themselves or to buy refreshments from enterprising stallholders. And many missed the whole of Lincoln's speech, a mere 272 words. But he made each word count.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now, we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Everett had described the battle, and had done so vividly. But Lincoln redefined the whole war, talking about the values of America as a single democratic nation. In fact, he used the word nation 5 times in what has become immortalized as the Gettysburg Address. Before the Civil War, people usually referred to their country as a plural noun. The United States are a republic. Afterwards, thanks in large part to Lincoln, they tended to say, the United States is. Lincoln anchored his arguments in the American Revolution, but he put his own spin on what the founders had done. They had ducked the issue of slavery in a land of liberty, for which the country was now paying an appalling butcher's bill. But at the beginning of 1863, Lincoln, by proclaiming emancipation for the slaves, had begun to redress that wrong. And then at Gettysburg, he rewrote the Saga of American Liberty to give meaning to a terrible present and to offer hope for an uncertain future. Those 10 sentences, delivered in a couple of minutes in 1863, became one of the great texts in world history.